Afternoon, this is Division 3 of the Colorado Court of Appeals, and we are convened this afternoon to hear three cases, two of which are highly similar, and we'll talk about that in a moment. The first is Larson versus, those are the attorneys, Anderson versus Vail Corporation, and I'll get this wrong, but Kiosian versus Vail Corporation, is that close?
Kiosian.
And last is Hadley versus Countrywide Home Loans Incorporated. We probably ought to get a preliminary matter out of the way before we do our normal advisement. These were originally set, the two bail cases were set at 1:30 with an hour allowed, and then the Hadley case was set for to follow at 2:30. At my suggestion, the Hadley case was moved up to 2 o'clock on the assumption that counsel would not want to argue what I think is an identical case twice and listen to the same questions, or answer the same questions twice. So I want to merge those two arguments into one argument. I talked to staff just before I came in, and They said you were wondering if you could have more time. I think we can set the arguments for 20 minutes aside on both cases and do them together. I mean, the only four distinctions, if I recall, are the exact injuries, the day the accidents occurred, and one was snowboarding and one was skiing. Other than that, they're almost identical. So. We'll take that case first, or those two cases first, with 20 minutes per side. And then at shortly after 2, we'll take the Hadley case. So let me say that we have read the briefs. We have read the authorities cited in the briefs. One of us has been into the record to a considerable extent. So the time you have for the argument is yours. You may use it any way you wish, but we would recommend that you go directly to the legal issues involved and not dwell to any significant extent on the facts, because we're familiar with the facts. The first case is set for 20 minutes aside. You may reserve time for rebuttal. If you wish time, wish me to assist you in that. I'd be happy to give you some sort of high sign when you reach the time that you wish to reserve. However, I would advise you that there's a lighting system on the lectern. The light will be green, I think, for the first 15 minutes of the argument, yellow for the last 5 minutes, and red when the argument is over. And there's also a module, reverse countdown clock, to tell you how much time you have left. So we would direct your attention to that. The lectern also has switches on your right by which you can raise or lower it. If you find it uncomfortably high or uncomfortably low, please feel free to adjust it. There's a microphone on the lectern, the purpose of which is to amplify the sound for the purposes of the audience and people present for the argument. The second purpose of it is to record the argument. We digitally record the argument now. It'll be on the internet a day or so after the argument. But we'd like to have you stay at the lectern so that we can clearly get a recording of what you have to say, and we sometimes review those recordings in the preparation of the opinion. We would ask that everyone in the room who has an iPhone, a BlackBerry, a cell phone, or any other thing that goes off unexpectedly and disturbs people, to please turn it off. So as it will not go off unexpectedly and disturb either the court or counsel in the course of what is called formally in the history of court procedures an argument, but which I think is probably more akin to a conversation, a two-way conversation. So if anyone doesn't have any questions, if no one has a question concerning how we're going to proceed, we're ready to hear Anderson and Kiosian versus Vail.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Larson. I represent the plaintiffs Jesse Anderson, Melissa Seosian, and Chris Seosian in these two cases. Before I get to the legal issues briefly, I've always viewed these arguments as a turkey shoot, and I'm the turkey. So I guess it is a discussion to some extent. At any rate, just so you have a rough idea of the lay of the land, if that was not conveyed in the briefs, because in preparing for argument with various individuals, it appeared that may be the case, or there may be some questions. The site diagram that you're looking at is the ski patrol diagram of the Seosian accident. There was none of the Anderson accident, but by and large, the path of the skiers was the same. This diagram is not to scale, and it is not accurate factually, but it gives you an idea of up and down and right to left. This is what's generally considered the upper treed area in the briefs. This is the lower treed area in the briefs. Both the Seosians and Mr. Anderson traveled through the upper tree area, crossed the overshot trail, and then entered the lower tree area, and eventually ended up on the road down here. And not to scale here is important, because if you look at these, this is 72 yards here, and this is the same distance, when in fact, from here to the wall that they fell off was 32 or 3 feet. This also does not depict accurately where the signs are. This makes it appear that there are 14 signs, when in fact there are only 9 signs. The mountain goes from top to bottom, and overshot cuts across from skier's left to skier's right. So you come down Primrose, you turn right onto overshot, and you cross. So they're skiing downhill this way across this trail, which is, again, not to scale as to width.
How wide is the trail at the point where the skiers crossed it?
Your Honor, I can't actually tell you that, because I'm not sure that we've ever measured that. It's basically a cat track. This is not a wide run like Bitterroot or like Primrose. This is basically a cat track that takes you from Primrose over to Bitterroot. It's probably wider than a two-track road through the forest, but not significantly wider. There are basically three legal issues that I need, or three legal principles that I think need to be kept in mind when considering whether or not summary judgment should be granted and whether it should be sustained. First of all, the burden is always on the moving party to show that there's an absence of disputed facts in its motion and brief. Second, even when the facts are undisputed, if there are competing facts that different inferences can be drawn from, summary judgment is inappropriate. That's been the law forever. That's the case we have here. The facts that the plaintiffs presented in their answer brief to the motion were not disputed by the defense. The defense simply brought forth other facts to the court's attention in its reply brief. Most of those facts are not disputed. I can't stand here and say there weren't 9 signs on overshot. That's
are there disputed facts? You say most of the facts were not disputed. Were there facts that were disputed?
There are not key facts, no, Your Honor. There were 9 signs, the location of which are not disputed on overshot. In relation to where the Seosians and Mr. Anderson crossed the trail, it's also undisputed that there was no boundary marking at all. And signs aren't the key here. It's boundary markings. You can close the area boundary by either signs or rope strands. Neither of those existed, despite the fact that on the diagram, this appears to have a rope strand across these two posts. This post also is not visible as you're crossing from the upper tree area to the lower tree area. It's around the corner. And that's also, those facts are in the brief, in Mr. Penniman's.
So as I understand Vail's argument, then they agree with you that none of the key facts are disputed, so why can't the trial court make that decision as a matter of law?
Because if you were to believe the facts that the plaintiffs set forth in their answer brief, the jury could find for the plaintiff. If you believe all of the facts set forth by the defendant in the defendant's trial brief, they can find for the defendant. because those facts compete with respect to the issue as to whether or not the boundary was marked in a fashion readily visible to skiers. That's the issue now.
That fashion readily visible to skiers, is that an issue of law or issue of fact?
I believe that's an issue of fact. The jury must determine whether or not the statute has been complied with based on the facts of the individual case.
That's the central fact in dispute.
Yes, sir. That's what now this case turned into. The third legal principle, before I forget it, that needs to be kept in mind, is that summary judgment is inappropriate when the argument raised by the moving party is first addressed in their reply. And that's what happened here. What happened was is that initially the motion filed by the defense said, hey, this guy signed a release, or these folks signed a release. And it doesn't make any difference what the facts are here. They signed a release. In response to that, our argument was you could not abrogate statutory duties in a release, even though that was their initial argument. In their reply, they didn't go to that argument. In their answer brief here, for the first time, they admit, oh, our release doesn't seek to abrogate statutory duties. We would never do that. But that's not what their motion said. So what happened here is the trial court adopted the reply brief almost verbatim and determined the facts that were in that reply brief, that those are the facts that that he was going to apply, the trial court did, to the statute. And I know Judge Gannett's a good judge. I'm not disrespecting him. But quite honestly, this statute doesn't need interpretation. It simply needs application of facts to the plain language of the statute.
You hired a ski safety expert.
Yes, sir.
And his report is in the record, and as I recall, parts of his deposition are in the record. Is there any dispute between the parties as to whether his report and his testimony was properly before the court at the time of summary judgment?
The defendant brings that up, and I believe we've answered that sufficiently in the reply brief. I mean, they say that we did not somehow appropriately bring it before you, but it was in fact brought before you in the appropriate manner. It was sworn testimony. It is usable in a motion for summary judgment or rebuttal there too. But again, I got ahead of myself, but what the trial court did here is it engaged in an extended factual analysis of the facts that the defendant put before it in its reply brief. Ironically, none of the facts that we just got done talking, well, not at least with respect to Mr. Penniman's opinions that it was not, that the area was not marked, the boundary was not marked, it appeared open to skiing, and that they failed to alert skiers that in fact was the boundary, that in Mr. Anderson's situation, the skis patrol's supervisor, Mr. Brooks, in direct response to my question as to whether or not the markings were sufficient, he said, or these markings were insufficient, he said, yeah, I can see how this happened. Mr. Blitzstein indicated that the markings were not visible, that there was no boundary markings visible where Melissa Cielosian crossed, and he can understand how this happened. Both, or all of the plaintiffs, indicated that the area where they crossed, there was nothing to indicate to them that they were going from ski area to closed area. Nothing at all. It's just not visible where they crossed. It's not readily visible. It's not visible. The best you can say is if you look up the hill, you can see some posts. Excuse me. If you look down the hill, you see nothing but the opening to Bitterroot. Because there is a rope strand that runs along this area, but it's not visible in the trees. You can't see if these are pine trees, and you can't see through the pines enough to see that.
Is there any dispute about what the glade, the forest, is skiable terrain?
Not that I'm aware of.
Open to skiing?
It is open skiing. That's, and thank you for bringing that up, Gary. Vail implies in its brief, in its briefing, that somehow the plaintiffs skiing through here were doing something inappropriate or wrong. This area is full of ski tracks. It's open for skiing. It is, in fact, a ski run as defined by the Act. It just doesn't have a name. The lower part is obviously closed. There were ski tracks in the lower area, however, at the time of the Cielosian accident.
Mr. Anderson's among them, apparently.
Yes, sir. He was there the week before, that's right. So there's nothing wrong. In fact, Dale expects skiers to be in there.
Pardon?
Vail expects skiers to be in there. It's adjacent to two runs that you can enter there any place along those runs. There's no prohibition whatsoever about skiing in those trees. But the trial court didn't address any of the facts that were brought up by the plaintiff in its orders. None. Not a single one. It never mentioned the fact that there were two ski patrollers that made comments with respect to whether these markings or whether the boundary was marked in a fashion readily visible to skiers. Said nothing about Mr. Penniman's opinions, said nothing about the plaintiff's testimony with respect to whether or not the area where they crossed was marked in a fashion readily visible to skiers. In the end, it comes down to that. And like I say, this case morphed from a pure release case into a factual determination as to whether or not some facts complied with the Ski Safety Act while others may not.
And the court made that finding. The court made the finding that the signs were readily visible.
It did.
Is that appropriate on summary judgment?
No, sir.
Why not?
Because if you read the statute, it says readily visible to skiers. None of these signs were readily visible to either of these skiers. Not signs, but their boundary markings. Again, I don't want to get hung up on signs. It's boundary. It's the boundary that has to be marked. And it has to be marked with either signs or rope. But that's not a matter of law. The Phillips case, ironically, the defendant comments on this. Phillips versus Monarch, that's what we're talking about here. The issue there, as pointed out by the defendant, for the jury, was whether or not the ski area complied with the language of the Ski Safety Act and then applied it to the, at that point, it was the language on the back of the ticket. It's the same as in this case. Whether or not they complied with the act, that requires findings of fact. And here, because you have two sets of facts, one of which can lead you to a verdict for the plaintiff, one of which could lead you to find for the defendant, that's for the jury to decide. That's the basic rule of summary judgment that was violated here.
What responsibilities did the skiers have under the act? We've been talking about the ski resort's responsibilities. The skiers.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
The skiers have responsibilities under the act. However, it isn't any more appropriate for the trial court to make determinations on the skiers' possible violations of their duties under the act than it was for the trial court to decide that the defendant complied with the act. The defendant makes an argument that skiers were presumed to have known and read and understood all the signs on the area. That's not what the act says. The act says that you're presumed to have read and understood the signs that are posted at the bottom of the lift, and then in conditions of decreased visibility, which that's never been made an issue here, you have an obligation to search out signs and determine what they may say.
I thought I read somewhere that that Vail was making the argument that by going into an area that they didn't belong, that the decreased visibility kicked in at that point and the responsibilities that go with that.
The first time that's been made is here in the Court of Appeals. And I'm not aware that there was any decreased visibility. In fact, I believe in our reply brief, Mr. Penniman, when he reviewed the site, indicates clearly that, and on both days that these two accidents happened, there was no weather conditions that decreased the visibility. The trees don't decrease your overall visibility, but they do in the short term. I mean, you have to be cognizant of the trees. But you can see that we haven't had that issue. That if that's the basis for summary judgment, then that's also inappropriate because that didn't get to be briefed, nor did it get to be responded to.
Increased visibility versus ordinary visibility been interpreted by any court or?
Not that I'm aware
of. Or in the statute or the regs?
I have not seen that, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
The bottom line on this is that if you take the facts set forth by the plaintiffs with respect to, or the offered facts by the plaintiff with respect to the fact that the law, that the boundary was not marked in a fashion readily visible to skiers, then a finder of fact can find for the plaintiff. On the other hand, if you accept, as the trial court did here, without comment as the plaintiff's facts, the defendant's proffered facts, then you can find for the defendant. That's why summary judgment was inappropriate. We have a couple of other minor issues they're not minor issues, but other issues that are brief, but I don't feel the need to address those. If you have questions on either the photograph that was used, I think we've handled that in the brief, or if you have questions with respect to clear and unambiguous, I'm happy to talk about that. But the bottom line there, again, is that they flip-flopped. The defense has flip-flopped with respect to, you know, what the release actually, what effect it has. Originally, it barred claims. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't bar claims where the statutory, where it abrogates statutory duties. That in and of itself renders it ambiguous. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. And I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel.
If I may move, do you want this over here?
If we could just move that a little.
Well, I can't see, so you can move that.
That's fine.
And I should have mentioned that neither of us have objections for using that before I start.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Peter Reitz, attorney number 15642, and with me is my partner, Mary Jill Falcone, and I represent Beaver Creek Resort. And I will be referring to the Vail Corp as Beaver Creek, just for purposes of consistency. As a brief roadmap, I will primarily be addressing the issue of Beaver Creek's duties with respect to marking their boundary pursuant to the Act and the responsibilities that are contained therein, which I believe goes to the heart of the matter that this court is here to decide. Similarly, I will be discussing plaintiff's failure to set forth a prima facie case of a violation of the Ski Safety Act. Appellant is asking you to look at one section of the Ski Safety Act in a vacuum or in isolation.
Counsel, are you not going to talk about the exculpatory agreement?
I am not going to talk about the exculpatory agreement. I'm not going to talk about the fact that when you leave a properly marked boundary, the area no longer has responsibility for you, because I believe those are peripheral issues, Judge.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you agree with your counterpart that you've effectively conceded that argument, that if you were, that by following the statute, there's no need to reach the exculpatory agreement?
I believe I do agree with that.
Okay, thank you.
We're asking you, however, to look at the statute as a whole and give effect to all its provisions. Put simply, the legislature did not want ski area operators to be subjected to the whims of a jury, and to effectuate this intent, provided a detailed framework as to the ski area operator's responsibilities on the one hand and the skier's responsibilities on the other. Beaver Creek satisfied those requirements for marking their boundary. Beaver Creek is concerned about the safety of their guests, their skiers and snowboarders, and knows what their requirements are under the Ski Safety Act. Consequently, they complied with their statutory responsibilities in erecting 9 signs over 303 yards and 2 rope closures, one at the beginning that spanned 44 yards. And by the way, this exhibit, if I may move away, Judge, just long enough to show you, the bold sections here of the diagram are the ropes. Here and here, if you count in between, there are 9 signs. So the diagram that appellant put in front of you is accurate. And I think this diagram is key to the case.
How wide is Overshot, do you know?
It's about 30 feet, Judge, although that was not measured at the time of the accident. I wouldn't have any problem with the 2-lane road analogy that Mr. Larson used. So I submit, as a matter of law, Beaver Creek complied with their statutory responsibilities. Appellant is attempting to make this an issue as to whether his client or clients actually saw the signs or not. That's not the issue here. And one of the plaintiffs didn't even look uphill because he was too busy looking out for the trees to miss them. And the other plaintiff doesn't even remember whether she looked uphill, both of which are statutory.
What would they have seen if they looked uphill?
Pardon me?
What would they have seen if they looked uphill?
They would have seen signs from probably the side, maybe a little bit of an oblique angle, Your Honor.
Now, are these signs, these 9 signs, that they would have seen the edge or approximately the edge of, Are they standard signs in the industry so
yes.
that everyone who sees them would know what they are?
Yes. They're standard international symbols for closed, and it says closed ski area boundary right underneath it. And that's undisputed. I don't believe anybody has questioned the nature of the sign and the marking contained therein.
Also, I'm sorry, go ahead. Is it also undisputed that the upper forest area was open for skiing?
That was an open area, although it was a treat area. No question.
Council, so you say it doesn't matter whether they could see the signs or not once you had the 9 signs up, or whether they looked for them or not, I guess is the way to put it. Is the test whether a reasonable person in that position would have been able to see the signs?
Well, I think that goes to what Your Honor brought up earlier, and that's the decreased visibility. And you have a responsibility to seek out and ascertain what those signs contain in an area of decreased visibility. And certainly when you go into a treat area that's forested, your visibility by definition is decreased. You've got branches and foliage and undergrowth and ungroomed snow surfaces. There's no question that it's decreased visibility, and therefore that duty arises on the part of the skier to seek out and ascertain, locate and ascertain the meaning of the signs.
Isn't whether the jerk... go ahead.
I'm not sure that he answered my question just
okay.
yet. The reasonable person. Is there a reasonable person standard that we're applying in this situation if these skiers didn't need to, if it didn't matter whether they saw the signs or not, given the way that they were skiing?
I don't think there is a reasonable person. I think it's whether they posted signage up there, and certainly with 9 signs over 303 yards, that's a lot of signs. It's frankly a sign convention.
So
I don't think there's a reasonable man standard, but you're talking about a ski area over thousands of acres where people are skiing down. You couldn't possibly put a sign up to contemplate every conceivable path of approach.
But who makes the determination about whether there were enough signs? I mean, what if there had been 1 sign in the 300-yard area? Does the judge still make that call?
Well, I don't think we're here to decide whether 1 sign. We're here to decide
I understand,
whether 9 signs.
But I'm trying to figure out
I understand your question,
here.
Your Honor. But
when
does
it ever become a jury issue? Is it always for the judge to decide based on the number of signs and the distance between them, whether or not it complies with the statute or not?
I think in order to carry out the legislative intent, which is clear, the Ski Safety Act, particularly with the 1990 amendments, it's very, very important that it's a legal question. It is not a fact question.
Whether the signs are readily visible to skiers is a question of law?
Absolutely.
I noticed that most of those, you indicated all the signs point face uphill, which would indicate that the ski area is anticipating skiers coming down through that forest to that trail, as opposed to skiing down the trail.
Well, the ski area is anticipating most of the people coming down the designated trail that has a name and a difficulty rating and is depicted on the trail map. Certainly there are people that go in the treat areas, but I think it's incumbent on them to know where they are, where they're going to come out of those trees, and where they are in location with respect to closed trails, or, for that matter, a closed area where you're going onto private property such as this one.
You were talking a minute ago about the responsibility of the skier in a reduced visibility circumstance.
Yes.
Isn't that the question? Whether the skier complied with that requirement, isn't that a jury question?
Whether the skier
complied with the requirements the skier is supposed to require, comply with, which, among other things, raises duties and reduced visibility. Isn't whether or not they breached that duty a question of fact?
I think in some circumstances, and again, we're talking a hypothetical that's fairly broad here, Judge.
I'm not talking about a hypothetical. I'm talking about 9 signs over 300 yards and skiing through the trees. Isn't skiing through the trees, whether their visibility was reduced and whether they complied with the requirements, a question of fact?
I think that could be a question of fact, Judge.
And why is it different with respect to the visibility of the signs and location of the signs? I noticed in studying that diagram at some length that most of the signs are up behind the houses. The gaps between the signs get wider as you get beyond the last house. And below those signs is a glade. Am I correct?
You are correct.
There's a glade all around those houses. It's depicted as being between the houses, but the glade is everywhere. The houses are hidden. And so you have more signs behind the houses, but when you get out to the end of Overlook, where these people went through, the gap is 72 yards, whereas before it's 30, 40 yards.
Yeah, I think it goes up to 50 yards, if I'm not mistaken. But you're correct, Your Honor. That is the largest space there. Again, Beaver Creek is contemplating most of the people coming down Overshot, skiing past the three large houses.
Isn't that a question of fact, too?
What's that?
Isn't that a question of fact also? Their anticipation of where people will be skiing. How they'll ski this.
I don't think that's a question of fact, Your Honor. I think if you're going to carry out the legislative intent of the Ski Safety Act, where the General Assembly clearly said the purpose of the 1990 amendments is to reduce the circumstances wherein an injured skier can sue a ski area operator. If you're going to look at this in total and as a whole, I think you're going to have to make this a question of law.
I think the trial court found, correct me if I'm wrong, that the reason this was not double roped was because the people who owned the houses could not cross the line without committing a misdemeanor because they have to go beyond the ropes.
That's a class three petty offense.
Petty offense. And the fact that these residents were to be ski in and ski out residences was important to them.
Yes.
Can't that be solved by a roped barrier with gates?
You would involve some kind of signage and some method of keeping the public from going through the gates, and the maintenance issues would obviously be more burdensome. But yes, we're not arguing that that's not feasible. It could have happened. But we still think that nine signs and the two double strand rope closures at the beginning and the end.
But you would agree nine signs a foot apart at the one end would not be adequate, wouldn't you?
I suppose that's possible. I'm not aware of anybody that would using common sense to do that.
Presenting to you the extreme. Nine signs side by side up at the upside end of Overlook would not be sufficient. The question is the number of signs, the distribution of those signs, and whether they were visible by people skiing out of that glade. Isn't that the issue?
I think that's exactly
the issue.
Isn't
that all
issues
of fact?
That's the issue that Judge Gannett comprehensively
reviewed. Aren't those all issues of fact?
I don't think so.
I think
it's a question, unquestionably. It's a question of law. Statutory interpretation in looking at the Act as a whole and carrying out the legislative intent of the General Assembly.
The court appears in its order to have interpreted the term visibility in the statute by referencing the legislative intent. Could you explain how the legislative intent influences the term visibility?
Well, I think, first of all, they put readily in front of visible. They could have very easily just said visible, which would make that a much higher standard of care for the ski area operator. And if you look up the definition of readily, it's without much difficulty. And I don't see how, frankly, not seeing nine signs and two rope closures that are there to be seen, it doesn't comply without much difficulty. I think that the way these signs were posted, it more than complied with the statutory responsibilities under 107 paren 6. And that's why our position is that this is a question of law, not a question of fact. Otherwise, you're going to throw the sufficiency of signs and the location of signs into a fact question, and you're going to have litigation. All it's going to take is somebody going down a trail, even if they pass all nine signs, and jumped in where that opening is into that private property and went over to the roadway. That's going to be a fact question. If they can get an expert that says, gee, you should have had one or two more signs, or you should have had another rope closure. That's not the intent of the Act. The intent is to reduce the number of situations and fact patterns when you can sue a ski area operator.
Yes, the ski safety expert hired by the plaintiff testified that the downhill rope, or at least it's in a report, but the downhill rope closure is not visible from where these people were skiing. Do you dispute that?
Yes, we do.
Okay. That's a question of fact.
That is a question of fact. On the left side, this is the Bitterroot run here, judges, and that goes 72 yards right down the skier's left. And if you're coming through here, you can certainly see that through the trees. That's our position. But I agree with you, that's a fact question. So again, I think the court looked at the legislative declaration, and I think it's important to read that. What they said is, the General Assembly hereby finds and declares that it's in the interest of the state of Colorado to establish reasonable safety standards for operation of ski areas and for skiers using them, realizing the dangers that inhere in the sport of skiing, regardless of any and all reasonable measures which can be employed. That's the legislative declaration that Judge Gannett looked at and was trying to carry this out and to render this as a harmonious result with the Ski Safety Act and the legislative intent.
If the Ski Safety Act is clear and unambiguous, you would never resort to construction of it, and which means you would never consider the legislative intent. Isn't that right?
That is right, but I think...
Is the statute clear and unambiguous?
I think it's clear and unambiguous to the extent what it says, but it does not cover the number, location, and orientation of signs in 107.6. So
wouldn't expect it to, would you?
There are locations for other signs in parts of the Act with respect to some of the lift signage that's mandated by the Act. And that's why Judge Gannett went the next step.
Are you saying that the statute that says readily visible to the skiers is ambiguous, but if you said down the boundary you have to have the signs 20 feet apart or 30 feet apart, that would be unambiguous?
That would be less ambiguous, yes, Judge. So again, I think Judge Gannett's ruling was clearly based on undisputed evidence of the 9 signs. He found that was readily visible as a question of law, and he also commented in his order that this case called for statutory interpretation, a question of law, which is what he applied in granting the motion for summary judgment. I talked to you about the importance of readily being in front of visible. I think the legislature put that in intentionally, because it's certainly not requiring that these signs be perfectly, absolutely, or effortlessly visible. That's just simply not a requirement, nor would it be a realistic one. The signs were there to be seen without much difficulty, and that is the key. And I think Judge Roman commented on the fact that the skiers have duties. They have duties in 109 that they must heed all posted information and other warnings and refrain from acting in a manner that may cause injury to themselves or others. When you couple that with the decreased visibility that you necessarily have skiing through a forested area, which then in turn requires you to locate and ascertain the meaning of the signs, I think this is unquestionably a situation where the skiers could have seen the signs if they'd made any effort, in other words, without much difficulty.
What do you envision? Do you envision that they would ski overlook, down overlook, before they would come down through the glade, that they had a responsibility to do that or something akin to that?
No, it's our position, Judge, that when you're skiing in the trees, because of the fact, and it's very much like skiing or actually driving your car. You're driving your car down a paved road and you choose to go on a secondary dirt road. You're not going to see the signage on that dirt road. Even though it's open for travel, you're not going to see the signage you are out on a paved road. Skiing in the trees is analogous to that. And by the same token, in decreased visibility, when you're driving your car here in Colorado in the winter and you're in a snowstorm on icy roads, you have a duty to slow down, proceed cautiously, and locate and ascertain signage and what it says. You have a responsibility for knowing where you are. A ski area, again, encompasses thousands of acres. How would you possibly put signs up that could contemplate the myriad different approaches that somebody could use coming through a forested area? You'd have to have signs every 2 feet. And by then, you're creating obstacles in and of themselves. So again, I think that the signage that was put up in this circumstances was more than adequate to comply with the statutory mandate under 107.6. And to find otherwise would run afoul of the legislative intent of the Ski Safety Act, which is clearly to reduce and narrow the circumstances where a skier can sue a ski area operator.
Where they can sue or where they can successfully sue?
Well, whether they can successfully sue, I would hopefully it would be.
I mean, you can't prevent somebody from suing.
A motion for summary judgment, and would be taken care of by that. There's no question this was an unfortunate accident. Both of the accidents were unfortunate. But the plaintiffs made an intentional decision to go into the woods, into the treed area, and ski in an area when they could have easily stayed on designated runs and ascertained where they were, scoped out the area, and then gone into the woods once they knew the layout of the area. Otherwise, you're going to have people coming into a closed run without knowing what's going on in the closed run. If you basically question the signage in every circumstance, and you come through the trees and you're halfway down the run, and the only closure is at the top entrance to that run, they could run into snowmaking, a special event, improper snow cover, equipment working out on the hill, and a myriad of other hazards.
Both of these skiers, if I understand correctly, had season passes.
That is correct.
Which would indicate that they ski the area regularly, perhaps frequently, perhaps over multiple years. They're probably familiar with the ski area.
I don't know, Your Honor.
But I mean, people buy ski and a year-long pass for a reason, I suppose.
Well, if they had been familiar with the area, I submit they wouldn't have gone where they went. And again, with Mr. Anderson in particular, but I don't know if either of them had skied these gladed areas before. So I would urge this court to find in favor of Beaver Creek and uphold Judge Gannett's ruling, correct ruling, that summary judgment was proper in this circumstance. Thank you.
I can't argue against every factual circumstance that was possible in this scenario. I can only talk about these two cases. Mr. Reitz.
Well, let me ask you this then. Or in spite of what you just said, can you respond to your counterpart's argument that everything becomes a fact question if we find that this is a question of fact in this case? I think he even used the example you could ski past 9 signs, but it would become a fact question if you had an expert say, well, they should have had a 10th sign up or whatever. How do we avoid all of this being litigated, fully litigated?
In other words, if in this situation a skier is proceeding down overshot and they pass this last sign, which is here, and then drop into these trees, is that a fact question? Then I would say yes. If this is the last signage, this is a simple fix. This is 227 feet. It's the largest gap. It appears that that's the end of the signage. That is a fact question. I agree with that. But that's not the defendant's argument. The defendant's argument is, if we place one sign here, we posted it. You have the obligation as a skier that you're skiing through these trees absolutely appropriately, as Mr. Reitz concedes, this is open, to go uphill to your left and find that sign. That's not what the act says.
The act applies to all skiers. All skiers skiing on open terrain.
This is almost elemental. You start with ropes, you stop ropes, and then you place signs so many yards apart. And at the bottom and around the corner, I disagree with Mr. Reitz, and we have a question of fact there, that this rope closure is not visible.
The defendant has about 50 pictures like that. But at any rate, Your Honor asked what you would see if you looked uphill, Judge Roy. And if you take a look at the defendant's reply in further support of its motion for summary judgment, Exhibit F, which is part of the record, there are two photographs in Exhibit F. The top photograph is designated as C. That photograph will tell you what you would see. And I submit to you, if you can see a sign, you have much better eyes than I do. The signs that were posted on Overshot are posted so people coming down Overshot can read them. They are actually slanted toward Overshot as you travel downhill on Overshot. When you cross Overshot and you look to your left uphill, no signs are readable and no ropes are visible. Mr. Blitzstein, the ski patrol supervisor, indicated that he knew it was a sign, and these are just rectangular signs. But he's a ski patrolman. But he said I could recognize it as a sign, even though all you can see is the edge of the sign. Again, this decreased visibility argument was first brought up in this appeal. It was never raised in the trial court and can't be grounds for sustaining summary judgment at this point in time. And there is no evidence that there was decreased visibility applicable to these two skiers. Once they got to overshot, had there been a sign or a rope boundary in front of them that would have alerted them?
This was private property instead of just a continuation of the trees they've been skiing.
I would readily admit that it would have been readily visible.
So does this argument boil down to whether or not visibility in the statute means able to be seen or likely to be seen?
No, it has to be readily visible to all skiers.
Right, but does that mean that they're able to see it or whether they're likely to see it? I understand that's not the language of the statute.
I think they have to be able to see it, not likely be able to see it. If you can likely see something, it means that it's not readily visible, because it can be unlikely in some situations. And what they're trying to do, with what the legislature's trying to do, is they're trying to protect skiers from exactly what happened here. Going into an area that was skiable, which, by the way, is also Exhibit F, Photo D. That's a view looking down into the area that the
sea. That's the photos you object to, are they not?
No. Okay. No, actually, that's a different photo. That's a photo taken on Overshot, looking downhill of Overshot, that was represented to the court to be taken from the treed area, and it is not. At any rate, we believe that there are issues of fact in this situation that needed that the trial court had to solve in order to get to where it got to. This is not an interpretation of the statute. It was an interpretation of facts. We ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank both counsel for their briefs and for their argument. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.